Tonight on the Daily Debrief, fresh insight into what the president of Michigan State University knew or did not know about the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal. Also, a verdict in the case of a Florida man accused of dropping his daughter to her death in the waters of Tampa Bay. And the man who admits to kidnapping a Wisconsin teen after killing her parents might be botching his chance at a soft sentence. The nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Tuesday, April 16th. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. Bob Hilla is here along with Linda Kenny Bodden. It's day four in a bumpy preliminary hearing for the former Michigan State University president who's accused of protecting sexual predator Larry Nassar. Luana Simon is facing charges that she misled the authorities about her alleged knowledge of Nassar's conduct. Her preliminary hearing has been occurring in a choppy manner. It began way back in February, but sat on hold until earlier this month. After 2 days of testimony in early April, it's now back in session. Nassar, of course, is the former Michigan State University doctor who admitted to abusing a number of girls and women. More than 100 spoke out against him at his own sentencing hearing. Nassar is serving multiple state and federal sentences, which will effectively keep him behind bars for the rest of his life. The question before the court today is whether there is enough evidence on the table to try Nassar's former top boss on accusations she lied about what was going on. Way back at the beginning of this hearing in February, Nassar survivor Amanda Tomasho testified that she reported Nassar to university officials in 2014, but that it took them a month to respond. The judge would not allow us to show Tomasho's face while testifying, but she has allowed herself to be photographed before.
So, did you hear from somebody from HR?
No.
So, we're in the middle of April. When's the next time that you heard from anybody from MSU?
About a month later. It was the middle of May. I was getting ready to head to on a family vacation that was scheduled for the end of May. And somebody, Christine Moore from the from MSU, called me to follow up on a complaint I had made about a doctor. She called me to follow up because she heard that I had made a complaint about a doctor at SportsMed, and she wanted to ask how I was doing and if I needed or if I wanted to tell her about the appointment. And that is when I explained to her that I had been sexually assaulted, and she used expressions of shock on the phone. It was clear that she had not gotten all of the details when I spoke with her on the phone.
Why do you say that? Why do you have that impression?
Because as soon as I told her what Larry did to me, where he put his hands without gloves or anybody else in the room and without asking for consent, she realized that I had been sexually assaulted and asked me to clarify the details. And after I did, she asked me to come in to meet with her in person.
This is the witness prosecutors claim Luana Simon attempted to silence. She came forward in 2014, but Simon's defense wanted to focus her on 2016. Here are some of the defense's cross-examination.
Prior to 2016, did you ever discuss Larry Nassar or your complaint that Larry Nassar had sexually assaulted you with Luana Simon?
No.
Prior to 2016, did you ever exchange any written communication with Luana Simon regarding Larry Nassar or your complaint that you had been sexually assaulted by Larry Nassar?
No.
Prior to 2016, did you have any communication of any type, written or verbal, with Luana Simon regarding any matter?
I did occasionally see her at tailgates. There's at the U of M MSU game. My father's a distinguished professor, and so we did come in contact, yes.
Okay, but no discussion regarding Nassar or what happened to you during your exam, nothing like that, correct?
Not really football talk, no.
And likewise, you never had any communications of any type with Paulette Granberry Russell regarding Larry Nassar or your complaint that you had been sexually assaulted by Larry Nassar, is that true?
Correct.
And that set the stage for what happened today. And today, one of Simon's advisors testified that usually, the president of the institution would not be involved with an investigation into sexual abuse. In other words, usually, Simon would not know enough about an investigation to be able to lie about it.
There was no written protocol, was there, to report Title IX investigations to the president?
No, there was not.
And copies of investigation reports were not shared with the president, were they?
To the best of my knowledge, they were not.
You didn't share them, did you?
No, I did not.
Title IX investigations are not typically reported to the president, are they?
The president would be aware that we had Title IX investigations, but the detail of those were not typically disclosed to the president.
A long, ponderous pause in there before that final answer, and later that same witness seemed to struggle to remember whether then-President Simon was indeed involved with Nassar's case.
To the best of your knowledge, President Simon was not involved in any aspect of the 2014 investigation of Larry Nassar.
I did not have any I did not ask Dr. Simon to be involved in any way, so to the extent of my involvement, I would not have asked Dr. At least I have no recollection, nor do I believe I asked Dr. Simon to be involved in that case.
You asked Ms. Moore to send you details regarding Ms. Thomashaw's complaint while you were at the track meet. That was so you could inform Dean Scrample of the allegations, is that correct?
That's what I stated was my recollection of the reasons for having her provide me with information.
And that's because Dean Strample was a unit administrator, is that correct?
Yes.
You don't have any recollection providing Ms. Simon with the details of Ms. Thomashaw's complaint that was set forth in the email Christine Moore sent to you on Friday, May 16th, is that correct?
That's correct.
In 2013 and 2014, Title IX investigations overseen by your office were not done in a shoddy, haphazard manner, were they?
I don't believe that they were.
Did you believe the investigations were handled efficiently and thoroughly by your staff?
I believe that they were.
The rules of evidence are extremely important. They govern what comes in and what stays out of a case. So listen to this evidence fight and think about what it says about this witness.
You specifically advised them that you do not recall what was discussed at the meeting on May 19th with President Simon. Is that correct?
Objection. Just because we switched attorneys doesn't mean we can go back and re-ask the same question. I think that's maybe number 7 or 8. I've lost count how many times we've asked that exact same question. So it's been asked and answered.
Okay, I believe so.
Well, except there's a new wrinkle, Your Honor. And that new wrinkle is 801D4. Rule 801D4 says that if the prosecution has tried to impeach this witness with what she said at her prior statements, then we can introduce those transcripts under 801D4, which is not hearsay.
I don't have a D4.
I'm sorry,
Your Honor. Maybe I can shed some light on this. It's very close. 801D1, that's exactly why this rule exists. Mr. Teeter called this witness an adverse witness last time, if the court will recall. Mr. Teeter represented to the court that it looks like this witness is telling the court something different live than what she told the investigators during her interviews. That's exactly why this rule exists. 801D1B. This is evidence of a declarant's prior consistent statement offered to combat an accusation of a fabrication. That is exactly what happened last week, and we are seeking to offer the prior consistent statements that the court needs to consider in order to analyze Mr. Teeter's contention on credibility.
I'm going to allow it then.
In other words, this witness has given multiple different answers to basically the same question. Look, earlier on in this case, an in-house attorney from Michigan State University got into this exchange over her handling of the case.
In your 2014 investigation, what did you miss?
Objection, Your Honor. The question is argumentative. She hasn't testified. She missed anything.
Okay, I can rephrase it. Did you miss something?
I did the best I could to follow process at the time, and without the benefit of hindsight, I think I did everything correctly at the time.
And when you say follow process, part of that process was guided by Michigan State's attorneys, right?
Yes.
Okay. And Michigan State's doctors?
Yes.
So all of them sort of told you the parameters of your investigation?
I had a context in which I operated, yes.
Were you offered access to any prosecutors or anybody with criminal prosecution experience to handle the largest sex offender in Michigan's history?
Your Honor, I'm going to object to relevancy. If you overrule me, Your Honor, I would like a continuing objection to this line of questioning, please.
Snarky questions aside, that same attorney said she never discussed the Nassar complaints with Luanna Simon prior to 2016.
Prior to 2016, did you ever have any communications with Luanna Simon regarding your investigation of Amanda Thomashow's complaint?
No.
Prior to 2016, did you ever have any communications with Luanna Simon regarding Larry Nassar?
No.
Prior to 2016, did you ever have any communications with Luanna Simon regarding the Dear Colleague letter that Mr. Teeter asked you about?
I don't believe so.
Joining me tonight for analysis on the debrief is attorney Bob Hilla, along with criminal defense attorney Linda Kenny-Bodden. So, Bob, let me start with you. You said this is great stuff. Why? I know it's not as bombastic as some of the really gritty murder trials that we cover, but these are people in positions of authority. All of them have six-figure salaries. They're all sitting up there, and they're giving little nuggets. This is important.
Well, it focuses on the real issues here with respect to whether or not Simon knew about Nassar's involvement, but also the nature. And as was developed here, there was some documentation that Simon had where it ties a COM issue, which was the College of Orthopedic Medicine, there with the sexual assault item on the agenda, even though it doesn't identify Nassar. So clearly she knew of the nature. So if she knows either nature or Nassar, then she has problems here legally. They at least showed that, and Russell certainly wasn't great in terms of saying that there was no connection or possibly no information that was given to Simon about Nassar specifically being involved.
Linda, you're nodding your head over.
Yeah, because Moore, who's the assistant general counsel, calls the assistant to Luanna Simon, right? What is she talking to her about? Why would the assistant need to know this? The only question here is, not only did she know about the investigation, did she know that there had been an accusation, not an investigation, and did she not tell the police, Luanna Simon? That's the question.
So I'm sensing unanimity here, at least among the panel, that Luanna Simon has some real legal jeopardy here.
And so does the college. I mean, you know, I'm incensed here. You know, you don't see me like this. Usually I'm a defense attorney for the defense. I am incensed about how this was handled.
The problem for these investigations is they have to be independent and fair. If they're not, mm-hmm. there's a real issue on credibility, and I think that's what you have here.
And again, why not call the outside agency? Why not call the police? Because when you've got in-house people who have a split duty, one to the, you know, the entity and then the other to the student, right, that causes a kind of conflict that an attorney would never get over.
Absolutely, absolutely. Never would happen in a law firm.
It's been a great day when Linda Kenny-Bodden agrees with my analysis here on The Debrief. Look, we're going to move along now. A man who admitted to kidnapping a Wisconsin teen after murdering her parents is refusing to cooperate in an investigation that will affect his sentence. Jake Patterson pleaded guilty last month to two counts of homicide and one count of kidnapping. In Wisconsin, pre-sentence investigations are conducted to inform a judge's decision. They typically involve interviews with the defendant. However, law enforcement sources say Patterson will not let them talk to him, and Patterson claims his lawyer gave him that advice. Patterson faces multiple life sentences for admitting to holding 13-year-old Jamie Kloss against her will for 88 days after killing her parents. Kloss managed to escape and run for help. Police say a Minnesota man accused of throwing a 5-year-old boy off a third-floor balcony at the Mall of America was looking for someone to kill. Those are their words. 24-year-old Emmanuel Aranda appeared in court today facing attempted premeditated first-degree murder charges. He apparently said that he was upset and did this because women were rejecting him. Court documents say the victim remains in critical condition after suffering multiple fractures and massive head trauma. And still ahead tonight here on The Daily Debrief, a verdict in the case against John Johnchuk. He threw his daughter into the waters of Tampa Bay. Is he insane or can he be convicted? The jury's decision is after this. A verdict this afternoon in the case of a Florida man accused of murdering his daughter by throwing her off a bridge and into Tampa Bay. John Johnchuk is the defendant, Phoebe Johnchuk the victim. She was just 5 years old when she died. Johnchuk's defense was that he was legally insane and could not be held criminally responsible. Here is the verdict.
We, the jury, find as follows as the defendant in this case. The defendant is guilty of murder in the first degree as charged. So say we all sign and date the person of the jury.
Votes. Should
immediately vote. After the verdict, the defendant was comforted by his attorneys, and minutes later, the judge notified him that he would receive a mandatory life sentence. During closing arguments in this case, the prosecution said that while Johnchuk's behavior was strange, it was not the result of legal insanity.
The defendant said, "I'm the Pope." The priest, Father William Swingrove, said, "No, you're not." And the defendant said, "Yeah, you're right, I'm not." You remember that? He said he's the Pope, then he takes it back. Dr. Otto, their own expert, said delusions don't work like that. Their own expert said that. The defense has told you that the reason why the defendant killed Phoebe Johnchuk is because the defendant was psychotic, even though he's never been psychotic like this before in his life. He was psychotic and he had a delusion that both he and Phoebe needed to die or the world would go to hell. Everyone would die. That's the delusion that he had, according to the defense. Dr. Macklin said both needed to die to save the world. There's an ice age coming. And then Dr. Macklin said he changed again right before and said he's God, or thought that he's God. So the delusion completely switches from demons and the whole world's going to hell to I'm God right before he does it. Delusions don't work like that.
Next, the prosecutor questioned why John Johnchuk is even still alive. Listen to this logic.
If the delusion is that both he and Phoebe both have to die to save the world, he didn't follow the delusion. Because last time I checked, he's still alive. He's sitting right over there in the purple shirt. He didn't die. He didn't jump. So if the delusion is that he has to die and Phoebe have to die, and that's why he killed Phoebe, why didn't he jump? If the delusion is that strong and that powerful, then you follow the delusion. That's what they're saying. But he didn't follow it because there was no delusion.
That's the argument that won the day. The defense, however, went unsuccessfully through a long list of witnesses who testified the defendant did have medical mental health issues.
The witnesses
all testified of some psychotic symptoms they observed Mr. Johnchuk exhibiting. John Johnchuk Sr., well, one, he establishes the severe, persistent mental illness. He says it started from when John was 5. They were taking him to USF back at 5. They had him on medication at 5. And you heard evidence that the records actually showed he was there for ADHD and also severe depression they were treating him for. And that he was being treated from the age of 5 up until the ages of 12 to 14. For a lengthy time to have a child on medication.
Back here again one last time for analysis on this case, Attorney Bob Hilla, criminal defense attorney Linda Kenny Bodden. So Linda, let me turn to you on this one. We have a split here. Certainly the prosecution argument won the day, but this reminds me of the split between medical mental health issues and legal insanity, not knowing that what you did was wrong. And this defendant fled. He ran from police after dropping his poor daughter off that bridge. That argument won the day.
It did. But there was a counter argument the defense had that, look, he thought maybe he was suicide by cop, the cop would shoot him, or he turned his car into the traffic of the oncoming police and thought he would, you know, hit them. He wouldn't, you know, he'd get killed that way. So there is that argument. But the real question is that, to me, the important issue is the mental health issue, not the verdict. How is he going to be treated wherever he goes? Because he needs treatment. And that's something that I don't think that they said it 27 times, 2 years, but lots of people have problems. The question was, did he have a problem at that point? Because he certainly had a problem after he got to the jail. He certainly was not able to deal with his counsel.
Exactly. You know, in most states, Bob, it's the Department of Corrections, not the Department of Punishment. And one has to hope that the back end of the system will have something here to at least treat some of these situations going on with this defendant.
Well, the interesting thing is I think the jury figured he's going to wind up going away one institution or another. But if he was acquitted by insanity, he could theoretically recover someday and be out.
John Hinckley, right.
Where he is going to go away for the rest of his life. And if he needs treatment, they can still put him in a psychiatric hospital.
So they thought that it was far enough down the chain here, that this was egregious enough where he deserved that life rather than just the treatment and the possibility at some redemption.
And not the high standard of clear and convincing in Florida.
Exactly. Okay, so great analysis here. Linda Kenny Bodden.
Thank you, Alan.
Bob Hilla, really appreciate this because you both make great points with both of these cases. And Linda agreed with me.
I know. The world might be ending.
We'll have to disagree next time, but we'll make an appointment for it. All right. We appreciate you watching the debrief tonight here on the Law and Crime Network. You can join us again, of course, at 5 o'clock Eastern for this recap of the best moments in the cases we're covering today. Of course, a new trial back in session tomorrow with the McStay case. We'll be here for you then. Our live coverage begins at 9 a.m. Eastern. Have a good night.